So today is the 30th of April, 2021. My name is Eleonora Neta. I am working as an oral historian for the Institute of Diversity and Civic Life. I am in Sardinia, Italy on a Zoom call with Meili. Meili, would you like to introduce yourself and tell me where you're joining this call from?
Sure. Hi, I'm Meili Kriadzis and I'm joining the call from Texas.
Thank you. Just to start, would you like to tell me a little bit about your childhood?
Sure. So I was adopted from China at 11 months by American parents. My dad was born in New York and my mom was born in South Dakota. And then my dad's side, the family extends to Greece, Turkey, and Albania. So kind of like that Balkans area plus Turkey. And then my mom's family, they've been here for several generations and they're white American with also some Native American as well from the Sioux tribe from South Dakota.
That's lovely. Thank you. And what is your relationship like with your family?
So I'm fortunate to say that I've always been very close to my parents. Growing up, I don't have any siblings, so I'm an only kid. I feel like, you know, spoiled as a rotten egg. It's nice to grow up as an only child, but also sometimes when I was younger, I wanted to have siblings just to play with, go outside. Although it was nice to hang out with neighborhood friends, but I thought it would be more fun to have like a constant playmate companion. But now that I'm older, I'm like, you know what? Yeah, I like being an only child. I like everything. Like I have my personal space, you know, have my alone time, no one, you know, so now I'm happy. But as a kid, I felt energy wise, like, oh, I wish I could expend this energy with someone else my age more often. Yeah. And so I've had a really nice relationship with my parents. I feel like I've always could, you know, trust them and talk with them about pretty much anything. And I'm lucky to say that they are very supportive. And I feel like we're, you know, such a great match as a family.
I'm an only child as well, so I understand you. So who do you consider to be a mentor to you?
Ooh, let's see. So I guess mentor, it kind of implies like non-family members, but I mean, I'd say definitely my parents, but outside that, I also some college professors that I'm really grateful to have encountered in those years because they helped me grow a lot as a person, but also academically, the experience of taking their classes, it made me really interested in academia specifically, and also up my writing skills. Like I was, some of these classes, I was kind of terrified, like, oh my God, you know, they're assigning so much reading, the paper lengths, they're so much longer compared to high school. So at first I didn't like it. And I even thought to myself, like, let's make sure not to take this class again, because it's so time consuming. Like you're here to enjoy college. Don't do that stuff. But then I realized if I wanted to grow and, you know, learn how to write better and, you know, just critical thinking skills, then okay, well, you have to struggle a little bit and work hard at it, and then have take classes from, you know, strict professors in the sense of grading. And yeah, I'm really glad I did. So if I guess I can name people, right? That's okay. Yeah, so Dr. Melissa Burns was definitely my primary mentor at Southwestern University, the school I went to, like 30 minutes from Austin. So yeah, she was one of my mentors over there. And I'm really grateful for everything that I learned from her. And yeah, I definitely, it's funny, freshman year, I was very intimidated by her course when I first entered it. And then I realized, like, no, this is an opportunity to grow. College, you know, college is fun, but also it's like, let's use the time to grow basically. Yeah.
What was your experience like in high school?
Ooh, let's see, high school. So my high school was a lot less diverse than my elementary and middle school. So elementary, middle school, I was really glad to be in an environment where you had people from various countries, people from various backgrounds here in the United States, different races, different religions. So it felt pretty like open, and I didn't even notice really, you know, about being a minority as a kid at those ages. But then when I went to high school, my family and I, we moved. So I went to a different, what is it called? Like district? I just can't remember the name, but a different, I guess, zoning thing. So then I went to a high school that was probably about 90% white, maybe more. And that's when I started to really notice that I'm a minority and that, you know, things are definitely much different than I thought the way the world worked, because the only previous exposure I had was elementary and middle school. But yeah, the high school environment, very white, very wealthy. So it was kind of confusing at first. And then I didn't notice this, but looking back now, I realized that a lot of my friends were either minorities, so Black, Asian, Hispanic, and also, let's see, my other friends were international students too. So white students, but they were like from Greece or France, stuff like that. So I felt like I clicked most with those people and probably subconsciously gravitated towards that crowd instead of, I guess what you might want to call in within the context of that school, that mainstream white social circle within that high school. So yeah, looking back, I realized that, and it was interesting to have that experience of going from a more diverse environment to such a homogenous crowd. And that's when I realized about what, you know, what it's like to be a minority, the kind of weird unspoken racial dynamics that play out that I never noticed before. And then in high school, it was just very odd, you know, and I can't say that I liked it in terms, especially by senior year. Oh my God, senior year, I felt I'm almost out. Now I'm going to allow myself to be more negative because earlier I didn't want to start with the negative thoughts because I knew that would ruin the experience anyway. And it's like, well, you got 3 more years. Why complain? You know, because it will affect academics negatively too. And I didn't want to let it do that. But yeah, by senior year, I thought, well, I'm almost out of here. I can be honest with myself and understand that I totally kind of hate this environment. So I started, you know, just kind of complaining with my friends and they're like, oh my God, yeah, I hate it too here. And then we just talked to each other about how much we hated it. Although we had never really done that so like openly before. I think it's because we didn't want to let negativity pile on so early. But to be fair, the teachers are for the most part were really good. So I'm grateful for that. And I'm still friends with some teachers from high school, actually. And now that I'm older and they're older and we're more like outside school, no school context friends, like we're those kinds of friends. Yeah, they've been honest with me. They've told me they don't like it either. So it's so funny to hear that from them too, because you know, you can't tell that in the classroom and you wouldn't want to, like you want to think the teacher loves the job or at least, you know, it doesn't have some sort of bias. But yeah, now that we're friends, they've definitely told me they are not huge fans of the crowd there. And I'm like, oh, okay. So it was not only me and my friends, them too, which made me laugh.
Did things change in college?
Yeah, a lot. So it's interesting, like environmental, I guess demographic wise, when I went to college, it was majority white, but I didn't notice at all that those same weird racial dynamics and the you know, the occasional openly racist comment, but then a lot of the more, I guess, ambiguous racist dynamics that maybe you wouldn't be able to even sense out if you're not a person of color. You know what I'm saying? But yeah, so in college, people were very open-minded. There was a mix of people, like I would say ideologically, it was mostly liberal. So not surprising, right? But there were also conservative students too. So there still was a mix of ideological backgrounds as well. And then I made friends with anyone there pretty much. Like I felt very open. I didn't have that pattern of only gravitating towards minorities and international students. But although actually I have to admit my best friends happened to be Asian, but I don't think it's because I only sought them out. It just happened to match personality wise. But yeah, I really loved meeting people at that college and the professors were amazing, just such a wholesome environment. And I think that kind of helped me grow out of developing too much of a chip on my shoulder from the experience in high school. Because in high school, after I graduated, I thought, wow, is this what the real world is? You know, like, is this kind of how rich white people act? Because if this is how everything goes, well then, yeah, I think I'm developing a bit of a chip on my shoulder and resentment, you know, which is never good. Like even at the time I thought that's stereotyping people and that's not good because I don't like it when that's done to me or friends or whatever. So it's not fair for me to do that, but it just was kind of more of an emotionally based reaction after that experience. And then in Southwestern, there were, you know, pretty wealthy kids and then all they, you know, white, but definitely not the same dynamics. And so I think that helped me be more open to people in general and not start to kind of just gravitate only towards minorities and international students and stuff like that. Just be open in general to everyone. So I really appreciated that experience too.
Yeah, and your reaction seems very fair. And I think that one thing that I didn't ask you was, what did you study in college?
Oh, yeah. So I studied the most useful undergrad degrees of history and French. Those are total job getters, aren't they? Like, yes, immediate job after college, immediate hire. But I picked those subjects because going into college, I had already had French credit. Well, I knew I would be able to get French credit by taking the credit by exam thing. So I took that, and then one of the French professors, I guess before, let's see, before the year started, he emailed me and said, you know, came back with the results, and he said, well, you have all the credits for French 1 through 4 here, and that means if you definitely can minor in French, no problem. But if you're interested, doing a major wouldn't be that difficult either, because you're almost already there, and you don't have to take all the credits, you know, starting freshman year. So then I thought, okay, sure, why not? Having a major in a language could look good, you know, for like international business or whatever the heck, you know. And then I eventually chose history because of my mentor, Dr. Melissa Burns, who was a history professor, and I loved her classes. And then I was really, really, really into the Algerian War for Independence. Like, I was full on obsessed. I still am obsessed, right? But maybe not as much as in college, but I really love that topic. And she, Dr. Burns, was also really focused on Algeria, actually, which is funny and a nice coincidence. So that also like made me think, okay, let's take more of her classes, more about Algeria, more of a academic challenge, and you know, to learn from this really awesome professor. So yeah, that's why I picked history, because you know, again, the Algerian War, right? Isn't that very useful for like a for future jobs? Yes, people are just knocking at the door to hear about Algeria, about the Algerian Revolution for Independence.
I mean, you're talking to another person who majored in history, so.
Yay, you get it. But yeah, I just loved it though. And actually, my dad, though, he did kind of push back initially. Because he would ask me, well, think about the future, you know, what can you do with this kind of degree? Maybe partner it, like do history, but partner it with something, you know, a bit more pragmatic, like business, or you know, something like that. And I mean, I thought it logically made sense, but I think, unfortunately or fortunately, I am the type of person who really wants to feel a passion for it. And if I feel kind of meh about something, then it's hard. It's kind of hard for me to do it, especially for something like a major. I'm like, oh, I don't want to major in business. Like, I'm gonna die. You know, I'm gonna fall asleep. No offense to business people that love that, but it, you know, just in terms of what we feel passionate about, different things, you know, for different folks.
Totally, I understand you. So about Texas, could you describe what your relationship with Texas is like, or has it changed over the years?
Yeah, so I guess growing up, I didn't think about Texas. I knew I was in Houston. Yay, go Houston. But then I think by high school, that resentment, you know, from that kind of those racist things and that weird environment, it made me think the rest of Texas was like that. So I think that's when I started to develop more of a negative impression of Texas as a whole. Like, ew, I don't want to be from Texas. People down here are racist, and you know, so much backwardness. And I kind of was totally unfair in that regard about Texas. Like, that's I developed, you know, like at a maybe an impression that someone from New York might think, like, oh, Texas, aren't they all kind of rednecks down there slinging guns? Although I think the gun carrying thing, I don't think that's exaggerated, unfortunately. Like, people have way too many guns down here. It's wild. So, okay, that one is fair. That impression is fair. But yeah, I think I had a negative relationship with Texas during that time, and also throughout college, because friends, they would say, like, yeah, I love being on campus, but when I go home to my insert small Texas town, it's a completely different environment where I can't be proud that I'm gay. Like, my family doesn't accept it. My community is religious, so I hate going home. I don't like this. And then, you know, other things too, you know, about like being negative experiences as minorities in different towns in Texas. So yeah, I don't think that really changed too much during college, actually, either. I'm like, oh man, this state really sucks. Look at all these people going home, not being able to be themselves, and feeling a lot of pressure from their traditional family and traditional community. So yeah, that probably worsened it, actually. But then when I came across IDCL, I think I really, at the same time, I really liked the emphasis on the diversity of Texas. Like, Texas is not just white. It's not just, you know, strong conservative. It's not just Christian conservative. It's actually a pretty diverse state, and we want to help break that mold of how people perceive Texas, both within and outside of the state. So that started to make me think more critically. Like, hey, maybe I've been so unfair to Texas. You know, maybe I need to calm down and not stereotype it. Yeah, basically. And I think you know, working as an intern with IDCL, that actually helped me be more open about taxes. But I still have to admit, I still have that impulse reaction where I'm totally fine saying I'm a Houstonian, you know, I'm an American. But if someone says, you're a Texan, right? I don't want to say that actually, even now. I'm like, no, I'm a Houstonian.
I see. And but is that why you joined IDCL as a whole, to sort of push back this narrative about Texas and that you also have about Texas?
I was super interested in IDCL because of the work that they do, such as focusing on diverse voices, interfaith work, you know, just things more along those lines. And then the Texas thing didn't really pop up in my mind until I read stuff about the diversity of Texas and what are the key goals, you know, of IDCL to expand Texas voices that are not, you know, that are outside of what people would think are Texas voices, basically. So yeah, the primary interest though was the interfaith communication and focus, and also the kind of more of like the social justice awareness angle. I really like that a lot.
That's great. And within this framework, what does Texas mean to you?
So now, I guess now, right? Currently? Yeah, I would say Texas means to me, I think, stuff like delicious food, like great barbecue. And then within various cities, I mean, so much international food, which is amazing, fantastic. And then in terms of people, yeah, Texas is diverse. Has a really interesting history, even although I had to take Texas history in middle school, which I thought was totally boring. But now looking at it, it's actually a pretty unique history. And, you know, I think Texas probably could do a better job of confronting things like being the last state to free enslaved people, like to acknowledge that, because I think the news reached Texas particularly late, and Texas didn't really want to do that either. You know, the history of racism here, segregation, and then, you know, racial injustice against Latino communities and Native communities as well. So I think Texas could do a better job reconciling that. So there is that diversity within Texas too, from communities of color, but it just didn't really make the history books because, you know, being people of color, we're disenfranchised in a lot of ways. So yeah, I think that's also what I loved about IDCL, you know, focusing on also communities of color and raising those voices, since the history books, they're always pretty white, aren't they?
Yeah, history is for the victors.
Yes, the winners write the history books.
Exactly. Virtually the saying is correct most of the times. But something that you may want to talk about is about your faith. Would you like to say something about that?
Yeah, so I probably should have included this in the growing up section, but I grew up in a kind of like a mixed religious, non-religious home. So my mom's Catholic. Well, she was Catholic. She was pretty practicing, at least in my early years. So I learned the Catholic prayers, and I'm still glad I learned those, because it's really nice, you know, to be exposed to different religions, and there's a spiritual comfort as well. So my mom taught me those, but she wasn't at all strict or anything. Like, you have to be Catholic. She just taught me them as a kid. And then I learned the basic Bible stories, which is really good for general cultural knowledge as well, regardless if you're Christian or not. Like, it's good to just kind of learn the basics of different faith and the overall general stories from the Bible too. And then my dad has always been a pretty hardcore atheist, so yeah, he would just be like, oh, you're going to church, okay, whatever, well, that's dumb. And he wouldn't mean it in like a cruel way, not like an actually angry way, but he would just kind of kid with my mom, like, oh, you believe in that, okay, sure, whatever. You know, and she would laugh about it. So it wasn't like a hostile thing, but I definitely knew my parents had very different conceptions of religion. And then, so I would say I was probably just, you know, general Catholic, I guess, you know, growing up. Like, I didn't think about it too much. But then I remember in probably like fourth or fifth grade in elementary school, a friend who's Christian, she was talking to me about another one of our friends who is Muslim. And I think I said something like, oh yeah, she's so cool. Like, she'll go to heaven, something like that. And then my Christian friend said, wait, no, she's not Christian. She can't go to heaven. And then I asked her, what do you mean? Why not? And then she said, well, you have to accept Jesus Christ as your savior, or you're not going to go to heaven. Like, that's the key to going to heaven. And then I remember that conversation definitely sparked a critical thinking moment about religion, like, wow, you know, it's pretty narrow to think that everyone who's not Christian is not going to go to heaven. So I think when I started thinking about that more intensely, I realized, yeah, I better be careful what I hear, you know, be careful what I think about religion, because religion is very comforting. It's nice to believe in a higher power, but the more exclusivist angles, yeah, I can't imagine if there is a God, like God, you know, telling everyone to go to hell unless they're the right faith. And I also thought, well, what if she's wrong? What if you're not Jewish or you're not Hindu or Muslim, you're going to hell? Like, what if you're wrong as a Christian? So it kind of just sparked those kinds of trains of thought. And then for a while, I ended up becoming atheist, more on the lines of my dad, like, oh, it's all bullshit. No way. I don't like this stuff at all. But then I kind of, honestly, this is an individual thing, but I felt, I guess, a little bit depressed at the idea of there being no God and there's nothing after life. And, you know, just kind of like a stuff not making sense. Like it's just random. And part of me still feels that way internally. Like it's very possible, you know, this is just, you know, a series of coincidences that have led to our being, and the universe exists, doesn't exist, and there's nothing more. You know, there's just energy and that's it, you know, in the more scientific sense. But in terms of personal comfort, I realized, yeah, I did enjoy believing in a higher power, whether I think that's willing suspension of disbelief or not, it still was comforting. You know, so then in high school, you know, those family projects you do, I think, I don't remember when, but there was like some sort of thing where it was basically look at your family history and learn about it, whatever. So when I looked on my dad's side of history, that's when I learned more about them being from Turkey, Greece, Albania. And then because of Turkey, I became more interested in Islam. Like, oh, what is this? This is interesting. My grandma's from Turkey. Well, she was born in Turkey. Let's learn more about this country. Because at the time, this is going to put like an age date on my dad. They were born under the Ottoman Empire. So yeah, I'm like two generations away from the Ottoman Empire, which is kind of surreal. It's like, wow, that's weird. But anyway, because of that, I became more interested in Turkey, Ottoman Empire, and of course, Islam is a very integral part to that. And then I guess I started more academically being interested in Islam because of that, knowing about Turkey. And then it seemed kind of spiritually comforting because of the concept of the oneness of Allah. And, you know, there's no intermediary, like, you know, Jesus being the Son of God, but also God himself, which I guess kind of confused me. And not to say that it's bad for people to believe that, but personally, I just felt confused about it. And then, so I think that's why Islam was particularly attractive to me, because of that, but also the family history. And it felt like a connection to Turkey in a way. Although I have a lot of connection to Greece, actually. I've been there before. I know some of the language. I can read it okay. Not the best, but you know, I can make it. I'm not going to die in Greece, right? If I got dropped in some random small village, I won't starve, you know? So I definitely feel like a cultural affinity and pretty, you know, fairly strong connection to Greece, which I'm really grateful for. But for Turkey, like there's like nothing, right? It feels like nothing. But through Islam, it kind of felt like more of a, you know, like a shared experience with that side. So yeah, I think that's why Islam was interesting to me, because of family, personal reasons, and then the whole more like oneness of God, and that's it.
So if I were to ask you, how do you identify religiously, what would you say?
I would say, I know there's, by the way, before I should probably state that I know there are problems with this term, but progressive Muslim. You know, and the problems with that term include things like giving the impression that progressive Muslim is better than other Muslims who are more conservative. So I definitely don't mean it in that way. I just, you know, conservative versions of religions definitely do not resonate with me as a person. Like, never have as a Catholic, do not as a Muslim. So that's why I say progressive Muslim, but not to mean it in like a demeaning way, just to be a descriptor. But that's some of the issues that can pop up with that terminology, but that's how I mean it. And then also maybe a little confusing, but a little bit agnostic too, because at the back of my mind, like I said earlier, I can't be sure. Like I can never feel 100% sure. And I guess that's what having faith is you just put faith in something that you can't maybe logically, that does not logically make sense to you in many ways, but yeah, you just have some faith. But at the same time, I think I will always have a bit of that agnosticism, like that agnostic approach, like, yes, no, I'm just unsure. I can't get rid of it. So maybe I would say agnostic Muslim for progressive values, which sounds like a bit of a mind twister in some ways.
No, but it makes sense with all that you've said. And yet, thank you for explaining that. But what role does Islam play in your life today, or has it played over the years?
So I think it's giving me a nice amount of spiritual comfort. Although recently, I mean, it's Ramadan right now, so I'm trying to, you know, be more regular about salat, about praying. But yeah, it's kind of like an up and down. Like sometimes I feel pretty spiritual and connected to Islam. Other times I just forget everything and I'm like, yeah, whatever, you know. So I think that's a pretty common relationship that people have with faith. Maybe it's not talked about as much, but you know, there's like ups and downs. Like yes, I'm connected, and then no, I don't really. Like that's not central in my life right now, but which is totally fine. Like the relationship can change. So I'd say right now it's just more like in the background, but still always there, which I appreciate, you know, but I'm not super practicing either at the moment. And never, I guess I never have really been.
Now that you mentioned Ramadan, last year, it was like this year during the pandemic. How has it been? Is this year a little bit better than last year?
Oh, well, not for me personally. I mean, I'm lucky to say I have the vaccine. I'm so elated. My friends also, a lot of my friends have the vaccines. Well, the ones that are here in Texas. So I'm able to see them, just still be careful, like not go inside crowded restaurants. We only eat outside. I only hang out with friends that have been vaccinated because I don't, you know, I still think it's good to be careful. There are other strains out there, and the vaccine is not 100%, so you still got to watch it. But yeah, with the vaccine out, I mean, I haven't noticed that much of a difference, because I wouldn't be comfortable going to a masjid right now because it'd be pretty full, especially during Ramadan. Like I don't want to go in an enclosed space with circulated air conditioning. So maybe I'm more, more cautious than maybe some other folks, you know what I mean? But I also live at home with two older parents. So I feel like a duty to be a lot more careful, even knowing that I live in a household with other people, be careful for them. So yeah, last Ramadan, I definitely didn't do anything. I'm like, no vaccine, not going anywhere. But I'm hoping this year that I can go to iftars with friends and, you know, just be cautious about it, but still, you know, engage more in that outside community type activity, you know, getting together with people. But last year I did not do any of that at all. I didn't fast last year at all. And I don't know if I will this year either, because ever since, I studied abroad in Paris in 2015, let's see, in the fall. And that was a really great experience. But then there was the terrorist attacks of November 13th, 2015, the Bataclan and the multiple targets that ISIS had hit. So after that experience, I feel like it affected my kind of like some anxiety eating habits. So when I noticed after that incident, when I would try to fast, that it would kind of trigger a weird anxiety thing in my mind. So I don't think it was mentally healthy. Well, for me personally. So I thought, okay, well, let me just cut down on fasting and, you know, maybe do it at the beginning or the end of Ramadan for like a week, like nothing too harsh. So I guess realizing that about mental health care, also, you know, physical health care, which everyone is aware of, but also the mental health aspect, that it's probably not the best thing for me to do too often. So I probably will fast maybe the end of this Ramadan, but not a lot because of the terrorist attacks and the kind of weird residual effects from those.
Yeah, and it's good that you were able to realize that there was a connection between the two. And so you were like, okay, I'm going to detach myself from this just, you know, for my own personal health.
Yeah, and I know there are other ways to partake in Ramadan as well. I mean, you know, with donations as well. And then also just, you know, spiritual reflection, however people envision that, whether it's the more traditional conservative ways of like, you know, or maybe more of like that. I know some friends, they meditate, you know, like not even praying in the traditional Muslim way, which is fine, like no judgment, but they find it like sitting alone, reflection, that type of thing to be invigorating, or, you know, just praying. More regularly for me, like that's nice. So it's really interesting, like what alternatives do people find to be fulfilling if one cannot fast?
Yeah, definitely. So I do have one last question, but before we wrap up, I wanted to ask you if there's anything that maybe I haven't asked you about that you'd like to mention.
Yeah, I'm trying to think. I don't think so. Yeah, I mean, I can't think of anything.
Okay. I mean, if something pops up, we can jump back to it. But The other thing that I wanted to ask you was that because this interview will be archived and people in 50 or 100 years may listen to it. And I wanted to ask you if there's anything that you'd like to share with future listeners, things that you really care about that, yeah, you'd like to mention.
Ooh, let's see, for people 100 years from now. Always a reminder that life is short and you got to live your life and just enjoy it, because it's kind of existential to think about 100 years from now, we're all probably not going to be here. So it just shows you how short life is, and 100 years feels like a long time, or like a long lifespan if you get to 100 years. But in reality, it's not, it's just like the blink of an eye, right? So that existential, the kind of that existential viewpoint of, wow, we're here and then we're not, just enjoy it, you know, just enjoy it while you're here.
Well, thank you. That's a good reminder, definitely.
Yeah, maybe not the most positive, but I'm like, yeah, you know.
No, but I get what you mean. I mean, historically speaking, 100 years is really nothing, really, really nothing.
Yeah, I'm like, wow, we're not going to be here in 100 years.
is there anything you'd like to mention before we go?
I don't think so, not at the moment.
Okay, well, perfect. Then in that case, I'll thank you so much for doing this interview. And I'll stop the recording.
Thank you.